people gonna rise like the water. We're gonna calm this crisis down. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter saying keep it in the ground.
Welcome to special programming honoring International Women's Day. This hour features powerful testimony from women on the front lines of climate justice activism. I'm your host, Hannah Wilson. On September 18, 2018, women climate activists from around the globe gathered in San Francisco for the Women's Assembly for Climate Justice. The day-long assembly was organized by the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International, known as WECAN. The Women's Assembly was part of a week of actions, including the largest march for climate the West Coast has ever seen, organized in response to the Global Climate Action Summit hosted by California Governor Jerry Brown. In this hour, we'll be hearing stories and analysis from Indigenous women from North America and the Ecuadorian Amazon, a poet from the Marshall Islands, which are threatened by rising sea levels, a representative of the youth-led Sunrise Movement promoting a Green New Deal, the director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, and an investigative journalist specializing in oil. We'll also hear voices from the streets during the Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice March that took place in San Francisco on September 8, 2018. So stay tuned. The first voice we'll be hearing is Candy Mossett White from North Dakota. Candy is Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara. She is the lead organizer of the Extreme Energy and Just Transition campaign with the Indigenous Environmental Network.
So dosha maraguets, marashima a ishuia hits. And in my Hidatsa language, I just said hello relatives. My name is Eagle Woman. My English name, sometimes I say colonized name, is Candy Mossett White, recently married. And I just want to recognize the original peoples of the land of where we are and to thank the original peoples for allowing us to be here today, even though there's a lot of buildings that have come up around since, and just recognize and respect that there were a lot of tribal nations that were here prior to a lot of us. So I'm from North Dakota, born and raised in a little town called Hazen, North Dakota. I was born. It's been an interesting time for me. Growing up in North Dakota was awesome. As a child, I was like, oh man, this is God's country. On the western side, it's the Badlands. It's really beautiful. And I grew up with my grandparents near Twin Buttes, just playing outside all the time. That's what I remember growing up. I was just thinking, this is the best place in the world. I did have a lot of people around me that were sick a lot in North Dakota, at home on the reservation called Fort Berthold, by the government. It's the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara Nations. We were all put there. And I used to think that it was normal to be sick. I went away to college, and I realized that a lot of people around me were like, why do you know so many people that have cancer? I was like, don't you? And they were like, no. And then I was 20 when I got cancer. So I was like, oh, this is normal. And I had to wait a week to get into my emergency health appointment and to get into Indian Health Service. By that time, the lump I had found in my stomach had gone from pea size to walnut size in 6 days. Turned out I had a stage 4 sarcoma tumor. And my prognosis wasn't good. So I remember my mom crying and everybody being around me crying and me telling them, it's going to be okay, you know, like patting them on the back and stuff. And thinking, at that time, it is going to be okay, I'm going to be fine. I really felt like that was going to be fine. But then the doctors and stuff would make me feel unsure. And I refused chemotherapy, I refused radiation, and there was nothing they could do about it because I was 20. I could make my own decisions. And I wanted to have children one day. And that stuff destroys the good cells along with the bad cells. 10 years after that, they said I was legally cured. But in that 10 years, I lost friends that had cancers that weren't even as bad as mine. So there are children walking around Fort Berthold today that are orphans because they have no more parents, lost to cancer. This is in our 30s. And now we have babies that are being born with RSV, which is an upper respiratory symptom. And I started learning that this is all because of the coal-fired power plants that exist in North Dakota, which is the first onslaught. Every single bit of our over 11,000 miles of rivers, lakes, and streams is contaminated with mercury. So you can only eat fish that are this big, and you can only eat them once a month, especially if you're pregnant, which I just so happen to be pregnant right now. But it hasn't been easy. My daughter's 5. I've had 2 miscarriages prior to this. And I blame it on the industry. I blame it on the water I'm drinking, because after coal came fracking. And fracking has been going on full swing in North Dakota since 2006. Since the Halliburton loophole was passed in 2005, the Energy Policy Act, where they were able to make a loophole on the chemicals that they put in the fracking. It's like Hershey's chocolate. It's proprietary information. They don't have to tell what chemicals they're using, these companies. So even if a cow or a horse drinks water that's frack water and drops over dead, and you test its blood and you see what's in there and you know that's the chemicals the company's using, you can't do anything about it in court. And this is thanks to Dick Cheney, who was the vice president at the time and who was also the CEO of Halliburton at the time. So if you wonder why fracking is so bad in this country and why they're getting away with so much, it's because of that 2005 Energy Policy Act that was changed. And then came the man camps, and then came all these people from around the world. So what happened to the women? Violence increased. We started getting raped. We just recently found Olivia Lombert, who went missing last October. She was found in the lake. We still don't know exactly what happened to her the night she disappeared and why she ended up in the lake. Add another one to the list of missing and murdered Indigenous women, because violence against the earth is violence against women. When that happens, we feel it. It's our blood memory. When we see them digging, just like at Dakota Access Pipeline, why were women running out there doing our war cries? Because we had to put our bodies on the line to physically stop this, which is raping and killing the earth. It is raping and killing us. We have a right to not only survive and thrive, we have a right to have our children survive and thrive. We have a right to be able to carry our babies full term. And we have a right to be able to have a voice for them when they can't speak for themselves. My daughter's not accredited to go into that GCAS summit, yet they're making decisions that are going to impact her. This has got to end. And we've been saying it for over 500 years as Native Nations, yet we're stronger together now because we see the strength in our diversity. Our sisters from the Global South are connecting with their sisters from the Global North. We're fighting back and we're saying, we're not going to take it anymore. We're not taking your laws and regulations. We're going to put our bodies on the line. Are you with us? The power is with us. The power is with the people. Don't let them believe the status quo of business as usual. And this is just the way it is. Supply and demand. I'm so sick and tired of them telling me it's supply and demand. How did you get to that action? How did you get to the Dakota Access Pipeline? I drove my hybrid vehicle, which took me like 12 years to pay off. Do I want to drive a Tesla? Sure, I can't afford it. Why are you allowed to build gas-guzzling vehicles that we know are killing the planet? Why are you allowed to make styrofoam that you know doesn't break down? Don't put that crap on the shelves. You are the ones that know it's bad. If I see one more commercial that tells me to turn off the water when I'm brushing my teeth while industry's wasting and poisoning billions of gallons of water every minute as we speak, I'm going to scream. They need to take responsibility. We have the power, the people have the power, we're the ones, we just need to make our voices a little bit louder. We need to collectively say, you take the industry, you're the ones, industry, that has the blame. Stop blaming it on the people, because the people have the power and we're sick and tired and we're speaking up. And I just want to end by saying, people, you say power. People,
power.
People,
power.
People.
Power.
Thank you all very much. much.
That was Candy Mossett White. Next, we'll be hearing from Nina Gualinga, a Quechua leader from the Ecuadorian Amazon, speaking about the fight throughout the Amazon against oil extraction.
My name is Nina Gualinga, and my mother is from the Quechua people of Sarayaku in the Ecuadorian Amazon, and my father is Swedish. I grew up in the Ecuadorian Amazon with my mother's family, my grandmother, my grandfather. So I've seen the beauty of life in the Amazon, life on earth, life on the land. I grew up barefoot, playing in the river, playing in the trees, working with my grandmother, getting up 4 a.m. to drink wayusa tea and talk about our dreams, our future, our vision, about our family, about education, and then go to the chacra where we plant our yuca and our plantains, work there all day, go back, eat some fresh fish, watch the stars, and listen to my grandmother's stories about what all the stars meant, the stories about the stars. So the forest and my grandmother taught me the meaning of the sacred songs, the secrets of the forest. Yeah, the Amazon, the rainforest, is really a magical place. But as I said, my father is Swedish, and I've also seen the privilege of being a Swedish person, and how that privilege is also destroying this beautiful rainforest and home that I also come from. When I was 8 years old, I was living in Sarayaku, where my mother is from, and this peaceful life became threatened by oil companies, and an Argentinian oil company called CGC. And I remember as if it was yesterday, this man called Ricardo Nicolás came to Sarayaku to a big meeting with all the women and children, men, elders, and he was offering us rice, tuna, he was offering us all kinds of things, believing that, you know, we would change, we would change our territory for what he was offering. The women told him to go back to Argentina. They were really angry. At that time, I did not speak Spanish, but, you know, you don't have to speak or understand a language to understand what people were feeling, because they were speaking in Spanish to him, and in our village, we speak Quechua, just to clarify. And he then offered us $10,000. It sounded like a lot of money, because at that time we did not have money in the community. We had a discussion about this with our people, and it turned out that it was $10 per person, because we were about 1,000 people in our community. So yeah, that was a really bad deal. And I was really angry, because I felt like, you know, this was really an insult. And the women were really, really, really angry, and they were screaming at him and telling him to go back. I call this my first act of resistance. So after this meeting, this man came up to us children and offered us apples, because there were no apples at that time in our community. The access to the community was really difficult, and we don't grow apples. And I told him no, and I ran away. And ever since that, I made myself a promise that I would defend my home no matter what. And if I couldn't do that, I would never go back. And I'm still living there. I had my firstborn child there in the middle of the Amazon. and we managed to kick the oil companies out of our territory. I recognize a lot of what Candy was saying because I have witnessed with my own eyes what the oil companies have done to our sisters in the northern Amazon and in our in a nearby community called Villano. Just like Candy was saying, there are children being born with cancer. Women have been raped in a systematic way by oil company workers. The rivers are polluted and they're still drinking the water directly from the rivers. The soil is polluted. They can't grow their own food. And it doesn't even exist a government in that territory. The government is the oil company and they do whatever they want to. They blackmail them, they threaten them. And as a response to this, in the beginning of this year, women from all over the Amazon, all across the Ecuador and Amazon, organized a march in Puyo. And for 3 days, we worked together with all these women from different nations across the Ecuador and Amazon on a mandate called the Mandate of the Amazonian Women Defenders Against Extractivism. This mandate contains 22 points demanding the government to kick out all the oil companies from our territories, demanding the government to make justice for all of those female defenders that have been threatened, that have been attacked in their homes, including my own family, that have been raped both by oil company workers and by other people that are against our struggles, and demanding justice for indigenous leaders that have been murdered because of their activism. And after we created this mandate, we went to Quito, to the capital of Ecuador, and waited for the president for 5 days outside the presidential palace. He didn't receive us, but his secretary received us, and we managed to get a meeting 2 weeks after where we handed over the mandate in his hands. And we're still waiting for a response from the government. I'm pretty sure that the women will soon make another mobilization because that's the way they work. And I just want to say that, you know, it's really thanks to those people and these women that are putting their bodies on the front lines, that are actually, you know, risking their own lives, that we still have rainforests, that we still have landscapes that are untouched and pristine. And, you know, it's the only real way to fight climate change, to keep fossil fuels in the ground. There is no other way. There's, you know, the carbon market, climate compensations, whatever politics that the politicians are making are not working. The only way is to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And the only way to do that really is supporting indigenous people. Thank you.
Hey, 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 Yakio, Yakio, hey, hey, Yakio, Yakio, hey, hey, Yakio.
We just heard Nina Gualinga, a Quechua leader from the Ecuadorian Amazon. The singer was Maria Dorsey, a member of Idle No More, San Francisco Bay, and a signer on the Indigenous Women of the Americas Defending Mother Earth Treaty. Maria had been in Ecuador with Nina Gualinga, standing with the women in front of the presidential palace. She taught the Ecuadorian women this song, called Women Warrior, learned from Canadian First Nations relatives, and they all sang it together.
Yakio, hey, hey, yakio.
Next, we will hear from the poet Kathy Gentnell Kitchener. Her mother, Hilda Heine, is the president of the Marshall Islands. These coral atolls in the South Pacific are already experiencing sea level rise and king tides that roll far inland. In the not-so-distant future, the islands may be completely inundated by rising sea levels.
I'm very fortunate that because of my performance at the United Nations Climate Summit in 2014, I've been able to enter more and more spaces and discussions on climate change using poetry and using my own personal experiences. And so this past summer, the Vatican invited me to write a poem for one of their first conferences, I think, that they've had, major conferences they've had on climate change. And I don't know about you all, but I am not super religious. So I was struggling a little bit with, what am I going to say? So I decided to focus on faith in collective action and faith in our ability as a movement to continue to fight. And so that's what this poem is about. The poem also was written during the time when the news of migrant children being locked in cages was everywhere. And I'm sure, like you all, I was devastated and just, I couldn't turn away. And so it found its way into my poem because I saw so much similarities between the two. And so this poem is my attempt to connect these two issues and to sort of understand this climate issue on another level. So it's called The Whale and the Birds. Lately, my four-year-old daughter has been full of questions, her mind a bird swooping to peck at every fragment, scavenging to name, provide order, find answers to her surroundings. This is my house. I am Marshallese and Samoan. My favorite food is fish and rice, she states, identifiers that steer her through the biting salt of an unfolding world. Her questions challenge me, teaches me patience of breath, of count to three, closed eyes, and yes, embrace her curiosity. Give answers that are honest, even if they are painful. Questions I am sometimes unable to answer, like when we watch the news and she hears my conversations and I have to say yes. Some people do believe that children can be illegal, and yes, some believe that families do not belong together. I must admit, I am haunted by the images of the soft brown of a child's skin against the cold iron of a cage, so similar to my girls. After the cold of a swim, joyful trails of sand grasping the soft brown of her skin. And is this not scripture waiting to be written? That islands that have until only 2030 to be habitable will create more children like these, searching for safe harbor, how fate awaits us in boats as well, how hate looks like willful ignorance and a nation that forgets its own settler history, and a man with a whale of an ego is similar to the whale in the story I tell my daughter at night. The legend of the whale and the bird, a whale who balloons with arrogance, taunts the birds of the skies, deems itself dominant, powerful. Is it so much of a stretch to see the similarities between the cruelty of dominant policies, how over 2,000 children separated from their families is related to rhetoric that denied the reality of rising seas, how 1.5 becomes a horizon farther and farther to reach? So the questions that challenge me continue to circle around faith. Faith to continue to fight when hopelessness is so much easier. Easier instead to let reports of island apocalypse and malicious loss sink below the surface to the dark depths, dark places no one can reach. As I think this, I pass little boys on the corner, cloaked in the blinding white heat of another afternoon in Mejiro. Cars swoop past, unaware of these two who slam scavenged green coconuts against concrete, shirts drenched, mouths wide open. They gulp down the sun, wipe their lips, glare at me for my staring intrusion. And in that instant, my phone signals an article. 600 people in Washington arrested by Capitol Police for standing against the whale's treatment of migrant families. And I am reminded, again, of the legend of the whale and the bird. How thousands of tiny birds fluttered across the sky, gulped down every drop of the sea, leaving an arrogant whale beached, thirsting, forcing him to admit that, yes, smallness is a state of mind. And yes, an ocean begins with a single drop. And yes, maybe answers begin this way too. And yes, so too does faith. Thank you.
I am Hannah Wilson, and you are listening to Testimony from the Women's Assembly for Climate Justice. The poem you just heard was by Kathy Jetnell Kitchener from the Marshall Islands. We will be returning shortly to the Women's Assembly, but first, let's go to the streets of the Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice march that filled San Francisco with 30,000 marchers on September 8, 2018. I was in the street asking folks why they were there.
It's a great, energizing feeling to join in with people not just from my own city of Chico, but people from all over the state here in San Francisco, and to raise our voices up. This is happening across the world, so we're doing this in unity with people all over the world, all different kinds of cultures, to say that we're sick and tired of a dirty environment, dirty air, dirty water, you know, and we don't want to leave this kind of legacy for our children and grandchildren. So I'm speaking up as an older woman who cares about life after I leave.
Tell me how old you are.
I'm 13.
Huh?
I'm marching today because I am scared that my future generation, my children's children, are not going to live in a safe, clean world.
Hi, so why are you here today?
Well, I work with 350.org. I'm here because we're rising for climate jobs and justice. This is a critical time, and we need a solution to the climate crisis. And that requires that communities, low-income communities, immigrant communities, communities from across the board be coming together to demand that our elected officials do better. Because all they are doing is spouting empty rhetoric and not actually doing the work of putting together bold climate action. And for us, that means a just transition to 100% renewables, and that means phasing out fossil fuels immediately.
One thing that's really important about this challenge is that we all have a budget. It's time, money, and hope. And I think one thing is we need to realize that we need to really reinforce hope sometimes. And there is a, you know, the battle between despair and hope. And I think a lot of people are stuck in despair and paralyzed. And I think that this movement and seeing that there's so many people motivated will hopefully bring hope to folks and spur inspiration to make change during the midterm elections.
Hi.
Hi. Tell me about why you're here.
I'm here because California is burning, and it is really concerning and scary. And we just really need to invest in our forests, and we need to invest in our planet. So I have, this is the only planet we have, for my children, for my grandchildren, and for you, for all of us.
You just heard the voices of women marching in San Francisco at the Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice march on September 8th. 2018. Let's return now to the Women's Assembly for Climate Justice. We'll hear from Marissa Zuckerman, a representative of the Sunrise Movement. It is a movement by youth in support of the Green New Deal.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be here. My name is Marissa Zuckerman. I'm 24 years old, and I'm here on behalf of Sunrise, which is a movement of young people uniting across the country to fight climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process and elect leaders who will stand up for the health and well-being of all people. I grew up in Oakland, and I've lived here for most of my life. And I can tell you that I have never seen anything like the beauty that has taken over these streets in the last few days. And I just want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for showing up on Saturday and Sunday and yesterday and this whole week. We created the largest climate mobilization the West Coast has ever seen, the largest street mural ever. And we made history in so many ways, but the best part is that this is just one piece of the ecosystem of movement and momentum and action of this week and this year and this moment. So Sunrise Movement launched 1 year and 4 months ago on the day of the last People's Climate March in Washington, D.C. last April. Sunrise was created by young people who have watched our politicians fail to take the action we need to prevent catastrophic climate change for decades, and felt a deep sense of anger and disillusionment and loss and heartbreak. We look around and see inequality and violence everywhere. Against the earth, against women, against black and brown bodies, against children, against poor people, against all of us. It's so ingrained into the fabric of this country and now elected so explicitly to its highest office and upheld by all of these interlocking systems that keep a very few at the top with so much power at the expense of everyone else. The day that Donald Trump was elected, we turned to each other and wept, knowing that this defeat meant 4, and hopefully not 8, years of precious lost time in the fight against climate change that we just could not afford, as well as the countless other horrors we've seen his administration roll out since then. I remember being terrified for my own future and for the millions upon millions who would be hurt by this administration. But I also knew that as the young people of the richest, most powerful country in the world who would be inheriting all these many interlocking crises, it was time for us to act. We knew we had to do something to shift the course of this country and contest politically for the change we need. Seeing so many young people politicized by the economic and political upheaval of the last decade or so, even before Trump was elected, the rising discontent with the establishment, we knew our generation was ready to get serious. So Sunrise was born. We were founded with the idea that it will take many, many thousands and thousands of us uniting together to build a movement that is big enough to call out the way our democracy and our climate has been polluted by big oil, and to build a government that is actually of, by, and for all people, not just a few white, wealthy men at the top. We started spreading across the country, sharing our message, doing trainings, doing road trips to seed these ideas, building local chapters, including one here in the Bay Area, of students and young people who are transforming our outrage at a lifetime of inaction on climate into grassroots political power, and making it clear to our elected officials that our generation will not settle for anything less than the bold, transformative action to stop this crisis and safeguard our future. And the way we're doing it is unusual. We're combining direct action and electoral organizing to create a strategy that calls out those responsible for the climate crisis while simultaneously shifting who holds power in this country. We're working to elect leaders who will have the courage to stand up for our generation's future, and we're organizing thousands of young people to do it together because we know that our generation has a crucial role to play. Organizing through the identity of youth is an interesting thing. Our society tells young people, especially young women, that our opinions don't matter, that our voices don't matter, that we shouldn't be loud or cause a ruckus, and that we don't actually have the power to change the world around us. And yet, students and young people have always been at the forefront of movements for justice. We haven't yet been ground down by cynicism. We're able to hold on to the vision of a better world that we know is possible. And we've really seen the power of young people these last few years across our many, many movements. Watching the way this spark has spread across the country has been incredible. Seeing other young people stand up in town halls and fundraisers to call out our elected officials for accepting campaign donations, whether it's from the NRA or Exxon or for doing business with ICE, and seeing them interrupt halls of power where youth voices are not welcome. It's inspiring. It's moved us to dig deep and to take risks and to find the bravery inside ourselves to do the things that we know must be done, even though we should not have to be the ones to do them. About a month ago, many of us were part of an action outside of Governor Brown's office, calling on him to protect our generation's future and to stop approving new oil and gas wells and announce a plan to phase California off fossil fuels completely. I was one of 6 young people, all women and non-binary folks, who were arrested that day. We spent the night in jail, cold and scared and hungry and heartbroken, at seeing up close the way this country locks up our people, but knowing that we were doing the right thing and fighting for our generation and for all the future ones who have yet to come. One of the things that I love about Sunrise is the way we're changing the culture of our movements. We are unapologetic at our grief, at what's being taken from us. We know it's important to hold space for the horror of what's happening. We are unapologetic in our anger that we have been left a total mess. And we refuse to accept that we are too young or that what we are asking for, a livable planet, which should be the most basic of inheritances, is too much to expect. But we're also unapologetic in our hope, and that's why we're called Sunrise. Despite all that's stacked against us, we believe a new day will rise. Some may want to call us naive, and in fact, some have. This past July, an 18-year-old Sunrise leader named Rose went to a town hall with Scott Wagner, a Republican candidate for a Pennsylvania governor. And after asking him about whether the $200,000 in campaign contributions he had received from fossil fuel executives had anything to do with why he had made statements saying that climate change was caused by people giving off body heat, he responded by calling her young and naive in front of a room full of people. Unfortunately for him, it was caught on video, and the hashtag young and naive went viral. We're also getting real about the level of action that's necessary to combat the climate crisis and holding our elected officials accountable to a higher standard. Having a D next to your name doesn't cut it. We're demanding politicians stop accepting money from the fossil fuel industry through a campaign called the No Fossil Fuel Money Campaign that just this morning reached 1,000 candidates and elected officials who have signed the pledge. And one of the things I'm really excited about is having us all, our collective movement of movements, think about what it would take to make a plan to see us through the coming crisis and the coming transition. We all know it's going to be no easy feat. It will require massive efforts and investments to the tune of trillions of dollars over the next few decades as we transition towards a 100% renewable energy economy. We will have to overhaul how we farm, transport, and consume foods, how we restore depleted ecosystems, and empower and protect the communities that are already affected by the climate crisis. We believe it's time for a bold political vision that addresses climate change while also working to address the numerous issues of our time: unemployment and underemployment, racial and gender inequality, and more. But for a long time, we've been fed the tale that we can't do these things all at once. We have to pick jobs or justice, a healthy economy or a healthy environment. But we're calling BS. We can fight climate change, create millions of good-paying jobs, and boost the economy, and work to end racialized inequality. Sunrise is in the process of starting to work on this through a Green New Deal, or Green Jobs for All, program that directs people to jobs that do the critical work of averting disastrous warming while also planning for the warming that cannot be avoided. A Green Jobs for All program would create 2 to 3 million jobs from green infrastructure alone. We could support displaced workers in the fossil fuel sector to transition to good-paying jobs in other sectors and ensure that such a program lift up the communities who have been historically excluded from economic prosperity. Now is not the time for incremental steps, and we can't let ourselves give in to despair. It's time for change. It's time to fight like hell to protect each other and our generation's future. And when I look around at the thousands and thousands of other young people and women up there standing up and sitting in and organizing in our schools and communities, I know we're going to be the ones to make it happen.
You just heard Marissa Zuckerman from the Sunrise Movement. Since her speech, members of the Sunrise Movement have sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office to insist that she promote the Green New Deal. The deal is being advocated by newly elected Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other congressional leaders. Let's listen now to Antonia Yuhas. Antonia is an investigative journalist and analyst specializing in extractive industries and oil.
Wow, what an incredible panel of women and Day of Women. Thank you all for being here and for having me speak. My name is Antonia Yuhas. Thank you. I have been researching, analyzing, investigating, reporting on the oil industry for a very, very, very long time. And among the impacts that have become increasingly clear in that process is the extreme disproportionate impact of not just climate change on women and children, but on fossil fuel exploration, extraction, transport, refining, usage, and disposal on women and children. And there are a myriad of ways in which that happens, in which we heard profoundly articulated already today. One of the ways, which we've also heard articulated profoundly today, is in the when women take in through either immediate ingestion from pollution, from water pollution, from eating contaminated food sources, or from contamination that has gone into the air in the form of pollution, fossil fuel waste, it impacts directly our ability to survive as a species. So it impacts a woman's ability to get pregnant, to maintain a pregnancy and carry it to term. It impacts the development of the fetus, and it impacts the health and well-being and livelihood of that child throughout their entire lifespan, including often a shortened lifespan. And we've heard the personal stories of women articulate that here today. I have been reporting on the industry for a long time, including 8 years reporting in depth on the BP oil spill, which meant, like many people, particularly those who live in the Gulf of Mexico, wading through oil-filled waters, through oil-filled beaches, picking it up in my hands. I had the incredible opportunity to spend 2 weeks on a scientific research trip that went out into the Gulf of Mexico. We went to the site of the BP oil spill. I had the opportunity to work with those scientists and go in the Alvin submarine to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico to get closer to the site of BP's oil drilling than anyone had gotten previously. We collected samples. I watched people study it. I reported on it for Harper's Magazine. What I didn't report was that I was pregnant when I left for that trip, but I wasn't when I got back. Thank you. And that's a story that is repeated for women, particularly those who live for generations on the front lines of these operations, and are well documented to be the impacts of that exposure. And I'm sorry, I'm looking at the faces of friends who didn't know that story, and I'm sorry that you're just hearing it here. I haven't told it publicly anywhere before, so thank you all for creating a space where I could share that. But those profound impacts of loss and the ability of our species to survive are why we are here, and the lessons and stories of women. So one of the things that I've also learned in my reporting is that women's stories, and not just their personal stories and experiences, their expertise, their analysis, their voice, their studies, their conclusions are not included in our reporting. And I've sought to fill that space and to fill it with analysis and storytelling. And I have had the incredible joy of being able to learn from and share many of the profound stories of the women who have spoken today and in this audience. And thank you for sharing those stories and entrusting me with that storytelling. I was covering Standing Rock for Pacific Standard and was interviewing LaDonna Brave Bull Allard. And she said to me, in 2014, she knew that the Dakota Access Pipeline shouldn't happen. And for one reason, she said, no one is going to build an oil pipeline on the grave of my son, because it passed so close to where her son was buried. And that death stuck with me as I was doing my reporting. And then I found out about the death of another young man who died building the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I decided to look at this, at the pipeline itself, not just the spills that have already happened, not just the many harms that the pipeline would cause, but the pipeline itself as a source of potential harm and threat and death. I started investigating. I spent a year investigating this story because it was so difficult to get through this mess of pipeline companies and their subsidiaries and their subsidiaries and their subsidiaries and subcontractors and subcontractors and subcontractors, which is how pipelines are built. They take a unique advantage of loopholes that allow them to have enormous distance between the parent company and the worker. I uncovered a second death of a young man, not as young man, a middle-aged man with children who died building the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I learned that nobody has ever, outside of private industry, run the fatality rate data for oil and gas pipeline construction. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has never provided that information. And they only rarely do it for oil and gas production. And when they do every couple of years, we've learned that the producing of oil and gas, the people whose job it is to do it, are engaged in one of the deadliest jobs in America. So I ran the numbers myself, because nobody had, for oil and gas pipeline construction. And what I learned was that this, too, is one of the most deadly jobs in America, with a fatality rate that is significantly higher than the average rate. And I started to ask why, and dove into an industry that has very successfully, through all kinds of mechanisms, shielded itself from some of our best occupational health and safety laws, which, as many of you know, aren't as great as they could be. But has shielded ourselves even from those laws and has protected themselves, being in an industry that is, in fact, one of the harshest on its workers, to one that is considered a low-hazard industry. And I dug into the causes and consequences, which you can learn more about, because I don't have a lot of time, but fortunately, I have a 10,000-word article that you can read. This is a year of reporting. In Pacific Standard Magazine, this is the print copy. It comes out tomorrow online, and you can read all the findings there. I also found that those conditions have, of course, worsened under the Trump administration with its aggressive deregulatory agenda. Also detailed, perhaps not surprisingly, how members and backers of the Trump administration have been directly cashing in on construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, on the increased production that has resulted as a consequence of it in North Dakota, and how that oil is being carried to the coast as part of a plan that Energy Transfer Partners is teaming up with Wilbur Ross, the U.S. Commerce Secretary, among many others in the administration and outside of it, to look ahead. They are seeing our successes and see a potential shift in electricity provision not being provided by fossil fuels, in cars not being run by fossil fuels. So they're building up and foreseeing their vision, a $100 billion increase in investments in petrochemicals. So moving all of that production to the coast, it's called cracking it, and shipping it primarily to China at this point to make plastics. So building up a petrochemical industry to build plastics. And this is their vision. What I propose in the article goes back to our friend Brave Paul Allard. And that is that water is life. And that is the green jobs. So I had this concept, which is that building oil and natural gas pipelines is very dangerous. Drilling oil and natural gas is very dangerous. But we have a necessity for water. Water is life. Clean, safe water. We have a decrepit system of water pipelines in this country. Flint is a very good example, but only one. We have a desperate need for a massive investment in building new, clean, safe, better water pipelines. It's the exact same unions, skills, training that a worker has, exact same for building an oil and natural gas pipeline. It doesn't matter what moves through it, except for that it's a lot less dangerous if water's moving through it. And those same workers, with their same unions, with their same training, can be moved over to water. And guess what they would become in the end? Water protectors.
You're listening to special programming honoring International Women's Day. That was investigative journalist Antonia Yuhas. Our final speaker is Osprey Oriole Lake. She is the founder and executive director of Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International, known as WECAN.
The climate crisis we know is urgent, and we have an even smaller window of time to take action. So we need a revolution. We need change. We need to move quickly. We need to move at speed, but we need to move well. We need new worldviews and social constructs of gender and racial equity, respect for human and indigenous rights, and governance systems that respect the natural laws of Mother Earth. And it's very clear that women are central to making this new world possible. Many of the women that we work with around the world who are impacted very severely by climate change, one of the first things they'll say to us is, you know what, we're not victims, we're the solution. And they're absolutely right. To address systemic problems women are advocating for and implementing models of collective ownership of their seeds, their plants, their forests, and they're working to localize their economies. Women are modeling small-scale solutions with large impacts, which is really essential to balancing and disrupting centralized and monopolized processes, which have actually furthered our crises. So it's really important to see that many of the solutions women have are small-scale, but when you add them up, they become a very big solution, and they really promote what so many people are saying, which is go local, go local. Women have the social capital to run these programs, and they are. In many countries, women vote more often than men, and when elected to political office, lead on environmental and social legislation. One example is New Zealand's new Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has banned all new offshore oil exploration as part of their plans to transition the country to a carbon-neutral economy, which was a very bold move that just recently happened. In developing countries, about 40% to 80% of all household food production is done by women. So when we talk about food security and food sovereignty, which is a key issue in climate change, you have to have women at the table. This is also true of water programs. All over the world, we see that women are the ones who are collecting the water, they have the water knowledge, they have to be at the decision-making table, they're the ones doing the work. In the United States, 70% to 80% of all household consumer purchases are decided by women. So in the global north, there's an opportunity for women in wealthier countries to use the power of their purse and their power of the vote to do what we need to do to move to a decentralized, democratized energy future. So women, know that you have this power. We can collect around campaigns, around voting, and around consumer products and moving us to clean energy. That's something that we're really looking forward to here in the global north. Importantly, historically marginalized women are leading the way. After Hurricane Katrina, Black women, who were disproportionately impacted by the disaster, also became very visible as powerful leaders, generating desperately needed awareness and activism concerning the links between environmental and climate justice, racism, and health and economic disparity. And at this moment, it's imperative to not only broadly lift up women's voices in leadership, but very specifically center the voices from the most impacted communities, Indigenous women, women of color, and women from low-income communities and Global South countries. These women and their communities have a long history of resistance and knowledge of the land and can offer solutions and effective responses to climate change and environmental crises. Uplifting and adhering to their leadership is not only morally right, but essential to the health of our people and planet. This is why, in the midst of dire challenges, it's heartening to see women coming together across struggles, borders, and cultures. Women are coming together to fight for climate justice, knowing that our love, because love is a big thing we're offering, love and our incredible dedication, which we are also offering, is more powerful than the corruption and greed of predator capitalism and institutional patriarchy and racism. Over the past years, I've had the honor to stand with many of my Indigenous sisters in ongoing fossil fuel extraction and pipeline fights throughout the Americas. And I'm always deeply moved by how the Indigenous women's voices shine boldly with dignity, wisdom, love, and strength in the midst of unlawful violence by state and corporate actors trying to push an oil and gas agenda across their territories. We are rising with them to say that colonization must end, sacrifice zones and environmental racism must end, violence against women's bodies by extractive industries must end, the desecration of Indigenous sacred sites and violation against Indigenous rights must end, and the destruction of the earth and water must end. And the women from Standing Rock movement declared within this context, "Mini Wichoni, water is life." This is a truth that continues to echo around the world. Say with me, water is life, water is life, water is life. In the midst of our many struggles, there's also a special element that women are bringing to our advocacy, which in these trying times should not be devalued or dismissed, and that is our spiritual and emotional intelligence. I have seen too often how women have been told that their personal, emotional, or spiritual statements are too soft or inappropriate for inclusion in an analysis of pressing social and ecological issues. But I would argue, in fact, women sharing from their hearts and brilliant minds is precisely what is missing from the sterile and stifling processes of most policy forums and decision-making institutions. And it's one of the things that is put out to disempower women, is to say that when we are speaking passionately from our heart, that there's something wrong with that, that it doesn't belong into these big power spaces. And I think that it's really important we encourage each other to bring our passion, because it shatters the patriarchy when we do it. So this is the time of women rising for the earth. We need to act now. The temperatures are rising, the oceans are rising, and so are we.
You just heard Osprey Oriole Lake, Executive Director of WECAN. The music was performed by the Indigenous women's group Ulali, singing Heartbeat Drum Song. Here's a translation from the Tutelosaponi language. The song says, "Our hearts are full and our minds are good. Our ancestors come and give us strength. Stand tall, sing, dance, and never forget who you are or where you come from." You've been listening to special programming honoring International Women's Day. I hope you've been moved by the powerful testimony from the speakers at the Women's Assembly for Climate Justice. I've been your host, Hannah Wilson.